All right. Well, I want a great book. I am really enjoying it.
Whatever Happened to Justice?
Yeah, I got just got it in the mail yesterday.
All right.
And I'm on chapter 7. I want my, my daughter. It's perfect for kids. It's just laid out really simple.
Oh, great.
Is it? I'd love to take a peek at it before you head out.
It's a fantastic book. Okay. Catch you back up a little bit.
Okay.
Jan and I went to the law library last week.
Oh, great.
And while I was there, I was wanting to do research on grand jury practices and came across this.
Oh.
The Manual of Grand Jury Practice.
That's useful.
Well, yeah, but not in the way that you might think.
Hmm. This is the state's regulations on the...
This is federal.
Okay.
All right. It's quite telly, even at the federal level.
Uh-huh.
But I was more interested in it for what it said on the inside as a referral to certain things than actually the actual point on the grand jury. And what they were referring to in here were two acts, privacy acts, and as how they related back to the Fifth Amendment when a grand jury gives a subpoena to appear and how they handle the privilege, I don't refuse to answer because I don't want to incriminate myself. And since I deal with a lot of people who have had and are receiving summons from the IRS, they issue two types of summons. They issue a direct summons to the individual, their target, and they issue a third-party summons that go to, like, when they're on a fishing expedition, to the banks and the credit unions and things like that to get records. And I got to looking in here at the different things, and they refer to these two acts, and I'm in the process now of studying it because I believe that those acts specify and clearly spell out what the banks can and cannot do, and what an individual can and cannot do. And the summons from the IRS are put in, developed in such a way that they appear as a command, but the only command you can have is from a court in the form of a subpoena. And if it's not a subpoena, it's a request.
Okay.
And as a request, you don't have to answer it.
So as usual, they're using fraud to get everybody to cooperate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, I found that quite interesting, and so I just wanted to share that. I'm still working on getting the brief up for it. Also, on your homework, were you able to find the...
Yeah, I found them, and I print them up, and I forgot to get them out of the printer.
Okay.
But I found, I believe I found 20. Powers.
Wow.
In Article 1, Section 8, I believe, and Section 9, or Article 2.
What about the other 9?
There was the powers of the Congress and the powers of the executive.
What about the other 9?
There was 29.
Gosh, yeah.
I thought you said there were like 19.
No, I said there were 18.
Okay.
There's 18.
Because I thought I found more than what you said.
Yeah, there's 18 enumerated.
Right. I found a list of enumerated powers, and then I found a couple extra that were given to the executive branch. So I added those in. There were like three of the executive.
Right.
So that I found.
The main power the Constitution gives Congress is the power to legislate. That's its main power.
Right.
And that's in Article 1, Section 1. That's the first paragraph right there. But what I did is I put this together. Now, up at the top, I was telling Jan, there's a conference call every Tuesday, 6 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number and the PIN number.
Okay.
And there's no charge or anything else, but Payman gets on the phone, and he talks to people from the East Coast to the West Coast. He will not end the call until everybody's had their questions asked and answered.
Wow, that's great.
And so I just thought I would pass that on to you. I've been meaning to do that, but
I
have forgotten about it. So anyway, what I did is I printed these up. The 29 powers are
listed. Oh, you found 29, okay.
Yeah, are listed in black, and the 18 enumerated ones are listed in red.
Okay.
So that's yours.
Great.
Okay.
Compare it with my list when I get home and see what I missed here.
Okay. And we were just discussing the lesson today is going to be concerned in talking about the 16th Amendment.
I didn't count 18 because it was like an enablement clause. Is an enabling clause the power to make or make laws necessary power? Well, I guess that's power to make laws. There was one where they have the power to. Yeah, I thought the power to make laws was like redundant to all this.
Okay, but however you got it in there, the let me give you the wording here in a second. And it starts off Section 8 starts off, Congress shall have the power to, and then it starts off from there, lay and collect taxes, to borrow money, to regulate, to establish, to coin money, to provide for, to establish, to promote, to constitute tribunals, to define and punish piracies, to declare war, to provide and maintain a navy, to make rules for the government, to provide for calling forth the militia, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, to exercise exclusive jurisdiction or legislation, and to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper. Those are the 18.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then the other ones that you found and so forth, and I think I have them all listed in.
Mm-hmm.
But in the enumerated section where most people get the 18 is from the fact that the preposition to borrow money, to regulate, to establish, and so forth down the line. They're identifying each one of the 18 and carrying it out from there. But anyway, one of the things that the lesson today is going to discuss is the 16th Amendment and the fact that it did not change anything at all. It did not change the law in any way, shape, or form regarding direct or indirect taxes. But the thing that caused so much argument over it is the fact that you can't have something in the Constitution and then an amendment that comes in contradiction. And that's what appeared to happen with the 16th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
However, that may be the legal point that most people argue on the 16th Amendment. But if we go to Article of Amendment 18, the 18th Amendment, we find, let's see, is it the 18th? Yeah, it is. I have this marked, but I have a hard time finding it all the time. Yes, the 18th Amendment was prohibition. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
However, with the 21st Amendment, the 21st Amendment says the 18th Article of Amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. All right.
All right. My point is they repealed the 18th.
Mm-hmm.
They knew enough of the law at that time to repeal it. So it's no longer there. It's out. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But there are several instances, and as we go through the course, I'll point them out in the Constitution, where they did neither repeal anything or they just simply added something else, which makes it in conflict.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly, I'm referencing, and I don't want to discuss it at this point, but I'm referencing when the Congress shall sit.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay? There's one section in the Constitution that says they're going to sit on a certain day, a certain month. And another section of the Constitution says they're going to sit on a different day in a different month.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one's never been repealed.
Hmm.
So legally and by law and construction, it still is the...
When there's a conflict, it's the earlier law.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Which you hear the argument a lot of times about we haven't had a Congress because they went sine die and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we haven't had a Congress when they made that other clause in there, which contradicts it.
Mm.
And so forth. Anyway, that's my argument. But we'll get into that a little bit further. I just wanted to kind of make mention of that because as we get into today's lesson and we get into the 16th Amendment, that will make more sense.
Hey, that would be a good argument to nullify all the laws passed by Congress since the second date was put in the Constitution. Because it's impossible for Congress to obey the law and the Constitution, therefore everything they're doing is null and void. Interesting argument.
Well, yeah. Mm. Be very careful, though.
I mean, self-constitutory law has to be null and void. It just can't be obeyed because it's self-constitutory.
Right. Okay. So, anyway, last time we were talking about how the government got jurisdiction over us and basically, well, I don't think we really fleshed it out too much about the state versus federal citizenship and stuff like that. We glanced at it, but we didn't really cover it, but we can get back into that later. So, what I'd like to do is just basically, as I was telling Jan, I'm taking Payman's transcripts of his earlier classes,
mm-hmm.
and I'm editing them, but basically I'm standing in his place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be reading probably for this lesson and maybe one or two others his transcripts to get his message across. I won't always do it. But this is one of these where I think it's better if I use his words because it just comes out
mm-hmm.
better.
Mm-hmm.
So, the credit for the next section, the credit for putting together the next session of this course goes to a famous freedom fighter named Larry Beecraft, who is a lawyer and he's famous for the cases that he's had and so forth. And he's been at this for about 20 years fighting in the freedom movement. And he's seen many freedom lovers over the decades going down in flames because of two things. Either they did not know how to look things up in the law library and they followed theories that were legally baseless, or they were unaware of a judicial conspiracy to protect and preserve the income tax. Were you aware of that?
That there was a conspiracy to protect and conserve? Yeah, I was aware.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll be discussing that a little bit.
That's why I stay out of courts as much as I can.
Absolutely. And Payman goes on to say, let me just mention again some of the most currently popular mythology theories. Sovereign state citizen versus U.S. citizens. A yellow fringe admiralty flag. The UN United States is bankrupt. Any use of the CCC or Uniformed Commercial Code, whether it was a UCC 105 or 1207, the UCC has nothing to do with the freedom and your rights from taxes and government oppression. Redemption theory and the straw man. And the latest one at this time is the expatriation movement. Or any reference to any kind of adhesion contracts, such as a driver's license or Social Security applications, that must be canceled or revoked or rebuked in some way to stay out of the government's jurisdiction. All of these are baseless arguments, such as staying out of the courtroom bar. There's a section that separates the audience in the courtroom from the judge and lawyers and the defendant stand. And everybody knows what the bar is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can
just
say,
follow on the argument, what is your name? What is your claim against me?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact is once, and we discussed this, I think, last session, if you're in Spain and you go before the magistrate in Spain, he's got jurisdiction.
Because you're on his turf.
So if you're there, they've got jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Whether they're willingly or you're in chains, they've got the jurisdiction. So the argument of staying out of the bar is valid from the standpoint that if you can stay out of the bar, okay, but they're not going to let you stay out of the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if it has... I have been told by some pretty reputable people, a couple of attorneys, one of them a judge, that the judges are told, no matter what their decisions are, they cannot make a decision which will create chaos against the public policy. So no matter what your argument is or anything else, right. No matter how valid, how sound it may be in law, they're not going
well,
to...
Well, also, you know, in the state of Washington, if you look at the Constitution, I was looking up the argument for public safety. So I looked up safety in the text of the state Constitution. The only safety that is authorized in the Constitution is the state to protect itself. Mm-hmm. We've given it the power to protect itself. Therefore, it can do anything it needs to protect itself. So if you're going to threaten it with a lawsuit for $4 billion because of two constitutions, they'll just throw you in jail. And we gave them the right to do that.
That's right.
So.
And the other baseless another baseless argument is the zip code in your mail. Now, there may be something to this on the sideline, and using the United Postal Union, all right? But insofar as the zip code is concerned, the federal government, which has been legislated by the legislature, which had the power to do so in the Constitution, that was one of the enumerated powers that given to the Congress, and it made regulations under the power to develop post offices and post roads. So in that legislation is a direction for a zip code to better enable the delivery of the mail. So right. Not using it, there's no law that says you have to.
Right. The Postal Service is a federal service. If you don't want it, don't use it.
But by the same token, if you don't use the zip code, you're not either getting in or leaving any type of jurisdiction.
Right. You're still using a
federal
service.
So it's a baseless argument.
Right.
Okay. The fact that you put UTDC under duress, under threat of duress and coercion. Okay. And why you use your own zip code on your mail. Now, there's a... something going around with the assemblies right now, the King County assemblies and the county assemblies, that you can become a postmaster. I'm a little bit leery of that. It's possible. I'm not saying it's not possible. But again, I don't see anything in the legislation from Congress, who has control over the postal system, that allows me or you or any other citizen to become a postmaster without an appointment from Congress. So be very, very careful about that theory. Okay?
The UTDC idea is that's a legitimate way to say that your signature is not your signature, but that's all it's good for, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and... by saying, if you're signing something under threat, duress, or coercion, that then gives you the right to claim the rights from the standpoint that if this is a contract, you were not apprised of everything on it. So therefore, it is either an ultra vires contract or a void contract.
What's ultra-virus mean?
Ultra-virus means like a corporation, and they have a charter, and they're allowed to sell oranges, Florida oranges in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If that's not in their charter, and they go sell Florida oranges in Hawaii, they're operating outside their charter, outside their authority, ultra-virus.
Mm, okay.
Ultra-virus.
Virus.
Outside of
V-I-R-E-S.
Venue, basically. Probably means outside of venue, literally.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So what happens is these theories come and go every so often, and this is typically what happens. Somebody takes on an old argument, puts a new twist on it, and it becomes a newfangled silver bullet. And you should do it this way and stay out of the system, according to their theory.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many of these things that come and go. And folks, through the years, I have paid cold hard cash attending seminars by these proponents of these theories. I buy their books and video and audio materials and try to apply them. And I see other friends of mine trying to put these things to use, and they just don't work. I'll tell you what. They all do work a certain minority of times. You could be doing the most worthless and baseless freedom theory out there, and it can work sometimes, and you can have people on the internet emailing you or at freedom meetings telling you it worked for me. Well, let's examine that just a moment. The 1099 issue. I know personally people who have received a check by filing the 1099 forms. I know a lot more people who haven't, and I know even more people who now owe a tremendous amount of money because of the penalties assessed against them. That is a theory that works sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's examine the reason why it works sometimes. Not just the 1099, but why some of them do. And
you know, some of these ones, they almost crack me up. I'll hear, well, you got to have this form, and you got to write a box around here, and you can't write in this area, and your signature's got to go over here, and blah, 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 and all this goofy magic form filling. And I'm like, you know, this, that can't mean anything.
Exactly. Well, Payman goes on to explain why it works sometimes and most of the time don't. But he says that the fact is that the people in government look at us as sheeple, people sheeple. Unfortunately, they're not very far from the former Soviet Union. All right? The people in government have their own set of rules, and they apply to themselves and the general public. They do differently. As an example, in California, people are becoming more aware that if a cop stops another cop who's speeding, they'll let each other go as professional courtesy. And all he's got to do is show him that he works for the jail system or the court system or that type of thing, and they let it go. Let me tell you a little story about professional courtesy.
Professional injustice.
There was this attorney and minister, and they were in a rowboat, and they were fishing. The waves started to come up, and the rowboat's getting kind of tossed back and forth and everything, and the minister's getting a little bit nervous, and so he sits down, and he starts doing his praying. And the attorney just continues to cast out there and doing his fishing. Pretty soon, the minister says, I really, really, really think we got to get back to shore. And the attorney looks at him and, well, yeah, I guess okay. So by this time, all the waves are just coming over and the boat's starting to get swamped. And the attorney says, well, don't worry about it. And he goes, and a whole bunch of sharks come up. And the minister really gets nervous now. And the attorney steps out on the back of one, the back of the other, and walks over to shore. The minister, whoa, whoa, whoa. So he does the same thing, follows him over. The minister gets on shore, goes down on his knees, and he says, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, and doing the cross and everything. And the attorney looks at him and says, well, what are you doing? He says, oh, he says, I'm giving blessings and thanking. Yeah, the Lord. He says, thanking, schmanking. He says, that was just professional courtesy. Okay. I'm sorry, I had to throw that in there. Sometimes the offense is so small that the hassle of writing a ticket or making an arrest is too much to bother. And this I can tell you for a fact. My brother is a policeman in Boulder, Colorado. Or Grand Junction it is, I'm sorry. And I had the privilege or experience of writing with him. And that's true. We came out. This happens on several occasions. It was getting toward the end of his shift, and he'd stop somebody, and it was basically a minor infraction or something, and he'd let him go because he didn't want to take the time to do the report to be late to getting home. Mm-hmm. And this is why sometimes, you know, and Payman goes on to talk about how he was using an international driver's license and how the cop looked at it and says, you could have made this in your garage, you know, and so forth. And then another time he was driving down the road and did an illegal U-turn. Well, it was raining, and the cop stopped him, let him go, on the basis that he was new in town, didn't know where he was going, and so forth. But it was also towards shift change. So it wasn't because he had his international driver's license? Probably not. So all of this stuff, see, my theory is, and this is John's theory, our laws are in the courts. They're twisted, and I won't deny that in any way, shape, or form. But the laws are there, and if you know how to present them in the courtroom, you can force the judge to honor them. Now, it's not always an easy chore to do that, and you have to know how to go about making it happen. But our laws are still there, and they're there and designed to keep you and I safe. That's primarily what they're for, and also to make sure that we don't harm anybody else. And that's what the purpose of the law is. And if you know that and know where it all comes from and how to put that into the court, the public policy will always be your worst enemy in court. It always will be. Because the judge is sitting there, and it's his job to maintain the public policy. The public policy is keeping everybody safe and keeping them in line. So if you're going against public policy, you're going to probably lose your case. Right.
Public policy is control equals safety.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, there's too many of us out there, and just because the IRS agent or judge or police let you go doesn't mean they agree with you. It just means they're too busy to worry about you. So, so what? The cop lets you go on the street. Why? Because it might be 5 o'clock Saturday night. He's getting off this shift soon. He's got a date with a girl he likes, or something else is going on. He doesn't want to arrest you, even though you show him your international driver's license he thinks you made in your garage. I had a cop tell me that one time when I was using an international driver's license. He told me that I probably made that in my garage. He didn't recognize it, but he let me go. I don't know why, and he did not tell me. Another time, late at night, I was lost in the rain. I made an illegal U-turn. I said, I'm lost. Where am I going? I'm not from here, from the area. He wasn't interested in putting a lost guy in jail at 10 o'clock at night. He didn't care about the driver's license, not being a California driver's license in this state. Does that mean he agreed with me and that it was okay to make the illegal U-turn? No. And perhaps this guy was just a nice guy, really, truly trying to help and felt he was a public service. The other guy that told me I made this license in the garage was one of those RoboCop types. He even looked like the cop on Terminator 2. Serious. I'm just a gun-slinging cop. So when they let you go because you've tried an unusual method, don't assume that's why they let you go. Another example, people get letters from the IRS and they do this method or that. Someone told them about a paper process and they challenged the government. They cancel their Social Security or write a letter back to the IRS agent, then they don't hear from the IRS for 6 months. So your friend says, see, see, they left me alone. It worked. I wrote this letter to the IRS. It was a wonderful letter challenging their jurisdiction and I canceled my Social Security or I expatriated or reclaimed my straw man for value, whatever the thing is, and that's what they why they left me alone. How do you know that's why they left you alone? Just because X happened and also Y happened, it doesn't necessarily follow that Y was a result of X. Very often these letters from the IRS are dumb computer-generated letters that the computer sends out and you're never going to get another one anyhow for another 2 or 3 years, or perhaps never. So the letter was going to come to you in the first place. If there was an agent looking at your case, maybe he got fired. Maybe he got transferred. Maybe he quit his job. Maybe he or she was in the hospital. Maybe she was pregnant and delivered a child. Federal employees are allowed to make maternity leave for a year or longer, then come back to the job. Maybe some new agent got the case. Maybe the agent has so many other bigger cases than you that you're not such a priority, and he puts your file at the end of the pile. In the I'll get to it later. Maybe you're judgment proof. Maybe you're not a 9-to-5 job with an easy paycheck for them to steal. The most vulnerable of all of you is the one who gets a paycheck. That paycheck is the most vulnerable thing because every year your employer sends out a W-2 IRS snitch form to the IRS and the state, and they know where your money is for them to steal. You could keep a very small amount in a bank account if you have one. Or you can choose to keep so little in there for the, or that they can't, you know, that if they do steal it, they don't get much. You cannot protect your paycheck from every month because it replenishes with the fruits of your labor and they can go to the employer, put a gun to his head and say, hey, buddy, give me his money or I take it out of your behind, okay? So just because it works sometimes doesn't necessarily mean that's the reason that it worked. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact... Now, you made a comment over here. I was going to interject that. Where was it? Oh, okay. It was talking about the IRS letters being dumb computer-generated letters. And they are. There usually is not an agent at the end of that letter. There really is not. Very seldom does it get to that point where an actual agent is at the end of that
letter.
It's just
an auto random number generated machine phishing thing.
They have a system in the IRS. It's called ACS, Automated Collection Service. Mm-hmm. The key, automated. Mm-hmm. So if your file gets sent over by a clerk, a supervisor, anybody, into the ACS, they're going to automatically send these computer-generated letters to you. Some of them need to be answered. Most of them do not. And if you don't answer them, or if you do answer them, it makes no difference, because if you do answer them, they're not going to go to an agent. They will go in and
they'll
not
get filed somewhere.
Yeah, usually the round file.
Yeah.
If you go back six months later and ask for a Freedom of Information report and ask for a copy of that letter, chances are they will have no record of it. Once in a while, they do. Okay? So, they're bluff. They're 99% bluff all the time. Anyway, about as far as keeping money in a bank account, if you have a bank account, that's only because we haven't covered or taught you yet how you can operate without a bank account or how to operate a bank account without a number. So that's coming up later on in the course. All right. But if you do have a bank account, my suggestion and advice to everybody that I talk to, keep no more than $100 in there. I mean, if they go after you for $100, yeah, $100 is $100, all right? buys a lot of coffee, but at the same time, it's not going to usually devastate you. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a couple thousand in there and you're operating off of that as a cash flow reserve and stuff like that, boy, they love those type of accounts. As they come in, they zap them. Once they got the money,
you're stuck. Yeah.
The chances of you getting it back are slim to none. You can get it back if you go about the right process. The IRS regulations state that you must first pay your tax bill that they assess you, then you can complain about it.
Can we assess penalties?
Yeah. Yeah, but you got to pay them first.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you get to go to tax court and bring your case up. Tax court is not interested in whether or not you owed it. They're only interested in how much you're going to pay of it. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, the best thing, really, and having said that, the best way to beat the IRS, if it gets to that stage, is to go to tax court. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like I just made a double-ended statement there. Mm-hmm. Tax court will follow the law, but they do it administratively. And you can bring the law in administratively, and they will follow it. So you need to know, you know, the scriptures tell us, know thine enemy. Need to know your enemy. Yeah. You need to know what they're supposed to do, what they can do, and how they go about getting it done. And then when they slip up, you throw it right down their throat. Mm-hmm. So again, that's what this course is going to get us into. So anyway, they're talking, so maybe you're not one of those and they cannot find where your money is. If you don't have a 9-to-5 job and you don't have a bank account, you're probably 90% out of the system where the IRS can't take your stuff. They don't bother because it's too much work. If you're an independent contractor, you get a 1099 snitch form sent out against you by the third-party employer, and they can get that, but it's much more difficult because usually independent contractors deal with several different people at a time, so it's not one source that your money comes from. If you're a business owner, you know it's much more difficult. Who knows why they don't get you? They have 280 million Americans, cheap citizens, to get. So just because they leave you alone doesn't mean that's the reason. That the reason is the letter you wrote or the SSN you canceled or the expatriation declaration you made or the accepted for value you sent. So people have these success stories of their own. They go to the meetings or internet and, yeah, I have this thing and it works for me, and other unsuspecting, trusting freedom lovers like you and me say, well, hey, if it worked for him, it should work for me too. Hey, I'll try it. Whatever. Right? I do it.
Well, when you're first starting, you don't know what to do, and you follow whoever seems to say they know what they're talking about.
Right. And again, experience, you know, is something you're going through that you wish to help somebody else was.
Yeah.
And I've had my experiences. I try and guide people away from that type of a situation. There are some things out there that appear now to be working, and I've tried a couple of them, and they appear at this point in time to be working for me, so I'll recommend them. One of them is the A4V situation by Doug Riddle, and his method apparently seems to work. Now, why did it work for me? I don't know. But as Payman says, it may not be because of the process. It may just be because they didn't want to bother with me.
Right.
Okay.
Now, you did that with an income tax return?
No, it wasn't an income tax return. It was a large medical bill.
Neat.
You can also lose with a perfectly good argument.
Yeah.
So the outcome does not say anything about the means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the problem is that because the majority of people who use it will not work, and they wonder what's going on. Let me tell you, folks, I've been doing consultation at $180 an hour, $3 a minute, just to get them out of trouble. I did this or that or the other, and it's not working. What do I do? Let's sit down, figure out what the situation is and what to do. I can give you example after example and why they are not working, the different methods. So anyway, let's move on from that. Any questions about any of what I call the Patriot Mythology or Tooth Fairy Santa Claus theories? Any questions on that subject matter before I move on?
Well, it seems like he hasn't proven that they're wrong. He's just said that you can't prove they're right.
That's essentially it.
Yeah.
Unless they're founded in a strong foundation in law.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to get in just a little bit. We're going to see some of Larry Beecraft's statements regarding these things.
And I've heard stories where people say, you know, I told the court their own rules and they just ignore them and throw them out and put me in jail anyway. And so I guess even if you're pleading correctly, you may suffer short-term losses, but if you appeal and stick with it and you go to the top, you eventually, if you're following the law,
okay,
you will get victory.
Okay, let me interject a personal situation. I had a credit card. I was paying on
first mistake.
First mistake. Okay. And I was paying on it. Got behind. So with conversations with the bank and one thing and another, I found out that they were charging me where they shouldn't have, and we argued back and forth, and they wouldn't correct their billing errors, and I just stopped paying. The result was they turned me over. Oh, no. Yeah. Keep this in sequence. They turned me over to a collection agency. The collection agency was out of Georgia, I believe it was. And so they sent me this nice, nasty letter. And I told them basically to go sit on a fence. Then they sent me a summons and complaint that wasn't filed. This is a favorite trick of a collection agency. That looked so official. It had the court caption, had everything on it, no court number, and no confirmation of file stamp. The summons, any summons that's issued from a court, will tell you that if it's not filed in the court, you, as the target, can demand that they file it, and they have to do so within 14 days after you demand it. Or it's dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't file it, so I sent him back, told him, hey, file the damn thing if you want, you know, and I'll take it. And he didn't. Okay. A year later to the day, guess what I get? Another summons and complaint. Mm-hmm. This time it's been filed.
Mm-hmm.
But this time it has been transferred over to a local attorney, Sutter and Associates, down on Mercer Island. Well, they pulled the same type of situation. And so I wrote up what I consider to be a good brief. And essentially, they could not prove that they were the end result.
Injured party?
No. They weren't the injured party, and they weren't...
Creditor?
They weren't the original creditor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having a senior mind. There's a term. All right. So I wrote up a brief and said, you're not, and prove it, and if you are, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So they went ahead and we had our first preliminary hearing in court. And the judge is sitting there. He's looking at all this. He looks over at the attorney. He says, well, he says, what bothers me here is I see no proof of assignment, which means that the bank did not assign it over to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he, we don't have one. And the judge says, well, I'll give you, I think he gave him 14 days or something like that. He says, unless Mr. Kirk wants to object. And I'm having so much fun. If I had objected at that time, it would have been dismissed.
Hmm.
But I'm having so much fun. And I don't have any objection. If he can bring it, let him bring it. That's what I'm asking for, is just the proof. Same as the court is, Your Honor. Bang. 14 days went by. Then I get a notice from them that they're demanding a mandatory arbitration. Okay? That's fine, too. So they send me a list of the arbitrators, and I do my research.
So they leave the court and they go to their arbitrators, okay.
Yeah, and so I got a list of the arbitrators, did my research on them, picked one, and did a brief. And then after I submitted my brief to the arbitrator, it was about 3 weeks later, he calls me up, and he said, have you heard from the opposing counsel? And I said, no, why should I? And he says, well, I have a notice here that they've withdrawn, and it's been dismissed. I says, well, that's great. He says, well, I'll verify that and call you back. I said, thank you. 5 minutes later, he calls back. I verified it. It's been dismissed. And did you know that you have, you know, do you want to continue this? I says, well, in what manner? He says, he said, you can bring a countercharge for damages.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, if they're willing to shut up and go away, so am I. Just forget about it.
For the sake of all the people that they harassed, I would have done it. Just as a kind of a class action.
I just had other things at that time going on, and I really wasn't bent on vengeance at that time. Although, in hindsight, I probably should have. Okay. I guess the whole point that I'm making here is you can do things right. And again, that was an illustration that if you know the law, and I'm not saying I'm an expert on it by any stretch of the imagination, but I did do enough study and in half through the years on the credit situation and what can be done and what can't be done. And I just brought the law up. And the judge ruled in my favor right off at the very beginning. And the arbitrator had no choice when I put that all into the brief to him. That's not a pat on my back or anything. It's to illustrate the point that if you do it proper, the law is going to be on your side. And that's what this whole course is about, is to get that information imparted to you. So anyway, Pema wants to go on here and talk about the judicial conspiracy to protect and preserve the federal income tax. And he says, first of all, I've never heard about this term until I was in the freedom movement 3 or 4 years, about 1995. So if you've been in this movement and you watch, you go through this freedom law school course, congratulations, you're doing better than I did. You came across somebody who introduced you to the judicial conspiracy to protect and preserve the income tax. Some people have told me, Payman, the understanding of this concept is so important, you should say it to people very early on and emphasize it. So here I am. This is how it works. Before we get to it, though, you need to understand the history of the federal income tax, how it started in the United States. First of all, there was no income tax at all on Americans' wages or compensation for labor of any sort until the War of the States, the Civil War. Lincoln started the income tax to help fight the war. He was waging against the Southern people. A few years after the war ended, that income tax was repealed. Then, in the early 1890s, another income tax was imposed. But it was struck down by the United States Supreme Court in the case of Pollock. You might want to remember this case. The Pollock decision. We will talk about that later on. It ruled that income tax is unconstitutional because it was a violation of the Constitution. To correct that problem, they passed the 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, so they thought they passed. Mm-hmm. They didn't pass it, but it was believed to have been ratified by the required 3/4 of the states to add the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. Anyhow, Congress then started another income tax, but it was paid only by people who made a lot of money for the time.
$3,000.
And the average person was not touched by the income tax until the Second World War, when we went to war with Japan in 1943. Roosevelt started the victory tax. By the way, to promote the victory tax, Roosevelt summoned Walt Disney to make a cartoon to promote the income tax, to promote the automatic withholding W-4 and allow for withholding from their paycheck.
Wow. This explains a lot.
He has a copy, famous, and I have a copy of that in Freedom Law School, and we have it on CD, and it's available. I haven't got it.
Or, explains where Disney, how Disney got where he got.
Yeah. And what's the name of that CD? I will tell you the name of that later. It's very well done. It's a very well done propaganda job. Donald Duck was the main character. So they fooled the American people to do your patriotic thing, to fill out the W-4, to allow your employer to withhold a portion of your pay for the war effort. Remember, we just got out of perhaps the worst depression in U.S. history and the 1930s Great Depression. By 1940s, we're going into the prosperity that wartime borrowing and spending created. By that time, we had the fraudulent federal system, the money system. So everybody had a job, was making good money, and we were doing wonderful, cash in our pocket, right? And we were fighting the bad guys, the Nazis, the Japanese. So nobody minded withholding from their paycheck. Almost nobody. Why? Number one, the men were at war on the war front. Husbands, brothers, and sons. And the women had to go to the workforce in large numbers just to fill our factories with workers. Until the 1940s, women did not hold jobs out there much at all. I mean, not only did we get rid of unemployment in the 30s, we had a labor shortage in the 40s. Everybody was doing good, and what spouse or mother would mind not having a little of her paycheck taken to support her husband, brother, or son in the war, where their lives were at stake? Of course they did it. The remaining men didn't mind either. That was supposed to be a 2-year temporary tax. Then the war ended. The victory tax was supposed to have ended, but they kept the automatic withholding going. And they kept having people fill out the W-4s and say, hey, you can get some of your money back, fill out the 1040 income tax confession form. So people started doing that and kept at it. The tax rates were lower for the average person, and we were doing so well economically, we didn't mind the taxes. I think the tax rate at that time was 3%. Only the very rich paid the higher tax rates, and they paid pretty high rates, up to over 80%. But they were for very large incomes, and those guys don't bother challenging stuff, right? They were paying income tax for decades. Well, the first challenge to the income tax was by a lady named Vivian Kellum. During the Second World War, she refused to withhold from her employees' pay. She said, I'm not a government slave agent to withhold for the government's money. If the government wants them to pay taxes, they can do it themselves. She passed away in the late 70s. I understand she was a very courageous woman. I never met her. She's the great-grandmother of the anti-IRS freedom movement. The grandfather of the movement, however, is a guy named A.J. Arthur Porth. Porth was a general construction contractor. He realized that everything we put on these 1040 income tax confession forms, that can be used against us. So he started going across the country educating and teaching other people what's going on. He's the only one really responsible, along with Vivian Kellum, spawning the other freedom movement leaders since then. Perhaps through other people, but he was a major force seconded by Vivian Kellum. They got the freedom movement going. In the 1960s and 70s, other people like John Kottmeyer, Bill Wexler, Marvin Cooley, Jerome Bailey, and others. Many others that got going, organizations with various names. And they went to court, and they made crude, rude, basic attempts at challenging the income tax. Let's face it, the 1950s and 60s, there were no copy machines like the old fax machines that the purple paper comes out curling up in thermal paper. You know, the construction contractors used the big thermal thing. That's how copying was done. The average person did not know they could go to law libraries and that they were available to the average people. There was not this modern-day freedom movement that you can go to a law library and look up and do stuff on your own like we have everything on the Internet. So there was no network of freedom lovers that were already there learning from each other's mistakes and successes. These were the pioneers, kind of like the pioneers that first came to America and the first ship or two that was lost at sea, people who landed in America. So Forth and the people who came after him all lost in the courts. Even though their attempts were rude and crude, they lost and they continued to lose. Why? Well, here we are going to court before a judge. What's a judge? I tell you what a judge is. The survey of the American people shows that the lowest level of respect is for a used car salesman, and then politicians and lawyers. And the American people have the greatest respect for doctors who care for our body. Then the clergy who assist us with our relationship with God. And above the clergy, next, are the government judges. Isn't that amazing? The American people have more faith in the priest of government than the priest of God. Whether they are Jewish, Christian, or whatever, they all have in common that they believe in the government more than they believe in God. They believe in the government's priest, the judge, more than in God's priest. But a judge is nothing but a lawyer who is also a politician. Lowest of the low, you take that same dirty politician that is also a dirty lawyer that we know is crookedly connected and put him on the bench. All of a sudden, he becomes your honor, the honorable judge, so-and-so. How about that? The fact is, this is the way people become judges. In most states and the federal government, you are required to go to the union of the lawyers called the bar. Freedom of law school is not approved by them. The bar is a union of the lawyer. As a union of the lawyers, they have to approve the law schools the lawyers go to. Now, what he's trying to say here is freedom law school is not approved by them. Then if you graduate from one of their approved schools, you can take the bar exam, and then you're allowed to be an attorney or lawyer to represent people in court. Otherwise, you cannot. So first, you have to go through that process. Try to make a living as a lawyer. Here's what it's like as a lawyer. Some of the better ones get to work for corporations. I call them lawyer factories, the huge law firms that pander to the rich. Companies and corporations and rich individuals. The others don't have as much money or are as well connected or have some decency. Perhaps they try to attempt to open their own law practice. Either way, here's what you got. By the time you're out of law school, you owe in student loans anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. You have to pay back for going to law school 3 years or full-time or 5 years part-time. Or your parents were rich and paid your way. If your parents were rich, you want to be rich like them, so you're looking at the almighty dollar. Billing hours to your clients charging hundreds of dollars per hour. My mom and daddy own corporations. They are executives in a corporation and have their own good-sized business. Why wouldn't I want one? So they don't have any understanding for the average person's situation. They want to make money. They want to be in that money race. They work in big cities like New York or L.A. or Boston. For the mega skyscraper companies and banks and insurance companies and all like that. The other ones who are in debt for student loans have to work hard to pay it off, so they have to be after the almighty dollar also. So do they get to work for you and I, the average person helping us out of the real causes? Doing the lawsuits that should be done? Can they afford to do a great freedom lawsuit that is worthwhile even if they want to? No. It's expensive running a business, paying for the rent of the office, the image, the mahogany table for your clients, and paying the student loans, assuming you are confident, smart, and organized. Many of them are not. Many people today become lawyers just because they want a good job, a good career, and you know, folks, lawyers have all the highest rates of suicide in America. That's correct. Psychologists were number one, lawyers were number two, or three, I believe.
Psychologists.
High degree of dissatisfaction with their job. So what they end up doing as a sole practitioner, yourself go or go with a friend of yours to a lawyer. What you typically, what's your typical way to make a living chasing ambulance, or make a living chasing ambulances, right? Suing insurance companies. Accident time on the back of telephone, accident time ads on the back of telephone books and TV commercials. Got hurt? You know we will sue for you, because that's for some money to be made. The deep pocket insurance companies, on the other hand, are to collect from. That's why most lawyers are in that situation. The lawyer says, whether he's the corporate lawyer or the ambulance chaser, it doesn't matter. He says, you know, I'm tired of trying to go out there and make money for a living. I bill the clients and the clients don't pay. That's a problem, by the way. The average person doesn't end up paying his lawyer because his lawyer didn't do a good job, or they got tired of ripping off people. Or they got tired of him ripping off people. They collect all this money, $20,000, to do jack for the guy. I can't tell you how often people pay $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 for an attorney who does nothing beyond saying, let's make a deal. That's true. Mm-hmm. Plead guilty. Gee, that's nice. I pay you all that money just to tell me that. So that's the reality of it. Anyhow, but so they know that being a judge is a well-paid job. The average judge in America makes $100,000 a year or more. That's right. Plus the pension, best insurance, best benefits, best vacation pay, and a government job, right? They get to play God. That's right, they get to play God. In the courtroom, they think they are God. No one can tell them anything. The worst that can happen if a judge is really bad, his fellow gods, I mean judges, can complain that they, hey, we're getting a lot of complaints about you, and they will only ask that he take it easy. And the higher court of appeals might reverse his decision if he makes bad decisions, but they won't punish him. The legislature almost never looks at judges and the corruption and how criminal it is. And the judicial review panels and the Commission on Judicial Performance, these committees are supposed to punish bad, hardly ever do. It's great. They get to kick back, and people think so highly of them. Everybody calls them judge. You're honorable in the community. It's a very coveted job. Student question. None of the lawyers that litigate in the court the judge serves in dare challenge him or dare litigate against him because their license will be pulled and they will be kicked out or deselected as counsel of the person they are defending. Payment. Oh yeah, the power of the judges. Lawyers too, that's true. It's a very powerful job that people want. It's well paid. So what lawyers do is they help their political buddies run for the legislatures. They go out and advertise for them, talk for them, raise funds for them, give money, donate money. Hey buddy, I'll help you become a legislator. And what's the reward back? When you become appointed to the legislature, you can appoint a judge. Nominate me, please. Tell the governor to nominate me. I'll give money to the campaign. It's a one hand washes the other. Now, in many places, like California, judges are supposed to be elected. But you see, part of the deal is what they know is that the judges almost never retire. They always retire early before the term ends. When the judge leaves his job midterm, like in California, the job of selecting the judge for that seat now is not done by the voters, but by the governor of the state. Political hack. A top political hack. He goes to legislatures and says to his buddies, hey guys, who do you want in your county to be supported? Who supported you? Hey, I owe a favor for this guy. I'll nominate him. I owe this guy a favor, so they nominate their own buddies and they get to put one of their favorites for the governor to appoint. Their own gold buddies. Now, once you're a judge, comes election time, some decent lawyer wants to run against you, or a citizen, perhaps. If it's allowed in your state to not be an attorney before you run as a judge, and on the ballot it says corruption, and this other, on the ballot it says occupation, And this other one is just an attorney or lawyer or businessman or teacher or whatever. Which one does the average voter hold in highest esteem? The judge. Of course, this guy's already a judge. It doesn't say he's been a judge for 3 months or 30 years. Just the fact that he's a judge is good enough. He's on the ballot, right? Mm-hmm. They see a judge, they vote for him automatically. So unless you're well known and you've been a real bad guy to a lot of people, then you're a judge, and when you're a judge, you automatically get reelected time and time again, and again and again. Only in extreme cases, the guy retires. There was a judge in L.A. who forced a defendant's wife to go to his home, have sex with him, and threatened to put her husband in jail. When this all came out, they had proof in L.A. and Orange County. Even the judge in Orange County said, "This is wrong." The judge resigned, but the prosecutor in L.A. refused to file criminal charges against him. They're buddy-buddy. Another thing I should tell you, the majority of judges in the county, in the country, were former prosecutors. One government lawyer job to the other government lawyer job. The guy's job was to put people in jail. He developed that mentality of a prosecutor getting the bad guys. When he becomes a judge, he doesn't put that aside. So you got this whole thing where we don't have fairness in the courts. Anyway, the freedom lover, like Arthur A.J. Porth, goes before the court and says to the judge, look at this Constitution. It says this, I cannot give any information to the government that could be used against me criminally. Fifth Amendment rights. The judge looks at the guy in the argument and thinks to himself, somehow, like, wow, you know, this guy is basically right. Maybe he didn't put it very good on paper, but he's basically right. So, but if I rule in favor of the citizen that's bringing this interesting stuff to me, I'm going to overturn the entire income tax scheme of the whole country. This is bringing the government trillions of dollars over the decades. Many thousands have been put in jail. Over the decades, many thousands have been put in jail for income tax evasion or income tax charges. All those people we judges have jailed have been illegal. Oh, we've been enforcing an illegal law? Oh my gosh. If I rule like that, all my political buddies and legislators will be mad at me. The average American will be mad at us because we've been ripping them off. We can't do that. We don't want a revolution on our hands. I'll be out of a job. So will all my buddies, so we can't have that. Hey, the average American is very happy. See? As long as they got food in their tummy, shelter, and a barbecue on weekends, and sports and soap operas and movie actors and actresses and sports heroes, they're happy. They're not complaining. They think the money's going to protect and defend them from bad guys. There are just a few dissidents, political dissidents. So they rule against you. Why? Because they got the power. That's why.
And they need to.
The freedom lover goes to the Court of Appeals. I know the higher court is better. The Court of Appeals will correct the judge. Now you have more seasoned political lawyers on the Court of Appeals. They have to go to another level of political approval by the legislature instead for their buddies to get up there. These guys don't want to upset the system either. So they rubber stamp the decision from the lower court judge. The freedom lover says, well, I'll go to the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court. The decision of the Supreme Court way back then in early 1900s, Breschebar and Pollack and Eisner versus McComber. You know all these U.S. Supreme Court cases. Everything just adds up that the whole income tax thing is illegal. This decision of the Court of Appeal is against the Supreme Court itself, right? Think about that. Mm-hmm. When the Court of Appeals rules in favor of the lower court, they are ruling against the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Rather than having to review and say you're wrong, they get an easier way out. The easier way out is to simply refuse to review the decision. Mm-hmm. Rather than having them to lie, they let the Court of Appeals decision stand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So right now you have on the books found the Federal Courts of Appeals decisions, all 12 Federal Courts of Appeals circuits, 12 of them made decisions about the income tax, which are in direct contradiction to the United States Constitution, Supreme Court decisions, IRS codes, and regulations. They simply cannot allow the fraud to be exposed. And they figured, hey, you know, it's the government itself that's doing it. What is the government? We are. Mm-hmm. If you want to go down to the basic nitty-gritties. So it's Congress, so let them go fix it. We don't want a confrontation between the different branches of government. Unfortunately, that's the case now. These guys took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, the judges, the congressmen and the senators, and the IRS agents. They all took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. Yet they all step on it. Because I tell you what happens. When people give into this government, the government develops a siege mentality. And you think about that. We give in to them, okay, man, we can just keep going. And so that's, you know, their mentality. The mentality develops that, you know, this government is so important to everything, to protecting life, liberty, property, and the way of life we have it. We have to protect it at all costs. Even if it means lying, illegally take people's money, illegally throw people in jail, even if it means we illegally kill people and then commit murder. That's why governments throughout the course of humanity have all murdered people. Doesn't matter if it's a republic, monarchy, or any other form. They all have done it and do it because they have to protect their deal. Unfortunately, that's what we have. Anyhow, the courts, one after the other, rule against you, and what happens usually is on the issue before them, the judges, out of nowhere, claim, you know, you're just wrong. You're wrong. That's it. And they'll rule against you. Originally, the case that says wages are not income. Well, the oldest case, Kraft, found that they ruled wages are not income, that he could find. Well, the oldest case that Kraft found, however, that ruled wages are not income, that he could find was back in 1981. Then, after that decision, the other courts, when somebody brings up that same issue, refer to the other court case. This issue was already decided by this other court in the case of so-and-so. So they just refer to each other, not to law as made by the legislature, Congress, or the Constitution, but by other judicial declarations. So the court says, or the Constitution says, this is the way it's going to be. The Supreme Court, way back when, said, yes, that's the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm. But a modern case comes up, and for whatever reason was put before the lower court in an inappropriate way or a manner in which they didn't do it properly, and so they got an adverse decision. Rather than trying to correct that decision, the other courts taking that same issue will now say, well, the other court decided that way, that's the way we're going to decide too. Mm-hmm. The hell with the law. Mm-hmm. Pardon my French. But
they screw up one case, set a precedent, and then obey the precedent and disregard the law.
Okay. So, in your folder material is an argument from Larry Beecraft. And also from Bill Conklin. And we'll get to that in a little bit here. But Bill Conklin, if you might want to write this down, he has a website at www.anti-irs.com, and he's got newsletters. Okay, and they're says here they're free for anybody to download. There's 22 cases that are listed on the money issue. People tried to go to court and argue, in essence, that they don't receive money, they receive Federal Reserve notes, which are obligations of the government. Therefore, they cannot be taxed. They lose, one after the other. The argument is basically sound on its own, but when the crooked courts run across it, they don't let it win. The Federal Reserve notes are an obligation. They cannot be classed as an income in any way, shape, or form. And as an obligation...
Because they're not money, they can't be income.
And because right. they're not money, okay, so there's no way that they can... And, but the first one or two, I think, actually went through the course and won. But the ones that came after that, again, you know, they had a wrong presentment and so forth. And the question from the student... The IRS Internal Revenue Manual at section 4.10.7.2.9.8 says that the Internal Revenue is not allowed to cite anything below the Supreme Court as justification that applies to all taxpayers. So why are these cases, the 22 cases, even in here? And why is the IRS even allowed to cite those circuit cases and district court cases in any of the responsive letters that they send to the taxpayers? First of all, I'd like to comment on that. I've never seen the IRS quote any court case. I never have. Mm-hmm. What they say is, according to decisions of the court, or according to the court's decision,
Yeah.
Now they'll quote the code, but they will not quote the case, particularly because most of the cases are district court cases. But they will refer to the fact that the Supreme Court has ruled, but they will not cite it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And I find that very strange. Also very telling. They don't want somebody with some smarts to get in there because they probably took their quote out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that to be a fact in one particular case. The IRS was trying to expand the meaning of the 16th Amendment. And the district, and they did in the case. And it's, you know, so if you took that section and quoted it, it would appear that that's what happened. But the court went on to say, not so.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Just because you say it so, don't make
like,
it so.
Like quoting without the word not in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well.
So, I mean, they play all kinds of dirty tricks. And they really do. And so, Payman says, sure, they just ignore the law and their own manuals. Let's go to page 65, and and here we find Larry Beecraft's dissertation.
This is Lowell Beecraft. Is Lowell the same as Larry?
Lowell. Well, they're one and the same. They're Larry and Lowell. I think Larry is the nickname for Lowell.
Mm.
I'm not positive on that, but this is attributed to Larry. It's a very interesting read, and I'm going to skip over here just a little bit. Page 67. On the second to the last paragraph above the pictures there on the right hand column, he says, I have just about reached my limit of tolerance for this quote movement.
Mm-hmm.
It surely is not the movement I want or desire, since lies are the order of the day. Do we hold ourselves out to be the American public as being worthy, credible, and part of a good cause? I think not, and this movement will obviously be rejected by most Americans because of our association with the lies. To prevail, we must be ready for the long, hard fight, and we must champion the truth. If this is not the objective of this movement, then I want no part of it. And again, that you have to go through and read the body of that, and I encourage you to do that. The mythologies that he's talking about here and the current silver bullet, man, this is going to get you free, this is going to do this, and you'll never have to pay any more money to your creditors, and blah, 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 blah. Again, when we get finished with this course, each of us will understand how to use a law library, and when somebody comes up with these claims, we'll be able to go there and maybe spend an hour doing the research that's necessary. And if there's any foundation to the claim, we'll find that as well. And if there isn't, we'll be able to expose it. Not only for ourselves, but for those others that might be taken in by the same type of rhetoric. So it's a neat thing, and it's small print, but it's about 4 pages long.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a lot of information. The court cases that are listed here are something that I'm going to, not at this point in time, but I'm going to encourage when we get into the law library section of the course to taking 3 or 4 or 5 of these and researching them and actually reading the case as opposed to what they're talking about here. And these are listed on the money issues, and they've all been decisions against that type of argument.
Hmm.
But it'll be interesting to read these cases and see how close they follow each other and what the premise of this whole thing is. A lot of times you can read a case and decide by the words that the judge uses. A lot of times the judge will tell you what to do in couched language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Helping out the prosecutor or whatever, right?
So right.
Do that.
Yes.
See him do that.
And
some real idiot prosecutors out there, too.
So we've got some exciting things ahead of us, and I think we're going to pick up on it. And on page 61, the argument, wages are income. Here is a bunch of cases where they've ruled against that argument. Now, this is precedent that's been set. And if you'll notice in the site, you'll see 9th Circuit, 8th Circuit, 11th Circuit, 9th Circuit, and so forth. These are circuit courts. So these cases have originally gone before the district courts and have been appealed.
See, some of them are intending well, but they are under the same guns we are.
But it's interesting that all these cases are in the 80s, except one here in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, one of the things, like Sandy said, some of the judges, in my opinion, are honorable people. Not all of them are. But those that are also forced politically through such things as the IRS, the National Security Agency, and so forth, because it's the public policy that they must protect. And they do this judicially from the bench, not trying to create chaos, but trying to keep chaos from happening on what I consider to be a false theory that if we tell them the truth, there will be a riot. Hey, let's have a riot then and get the truth out.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. But Dred they Scott, don't want the
Dred
right.
Scott was a case of convenience just as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
I mean, to avoid a war. Mm-hmm. And the war came anyway, so...
Right.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, from the position of cooler heads will prevail, if you really put out...
If everyone honors truth, then it will resolve itself. Right. Yeah. Peacefully.
So, anyway, he goes on. Payment goes on and says... Wages are not income. Now, we have 12 different cases on page 61 of your folder there. In my opinion, you have to find out and verify this for yourself. The average person's wages are not income according to law, but the courts have said that they are. So, and then another mythology is that the IRS's Delaware corporation is a worthless tooth fairy theory. Hmm. Argument over this argument that claim that the Secretary of Treasury is an agent of the International Monetary Fund. That is an absolutely worthless argument. People have been ruled against. Non-resident aliens. This is because people claim because of the 14th Amendment they are sovereign state citizens. Therefore, non-residents of singular government in Washington, D.C. That's been overruled. Next, because it's a worthless theory. Judicial conspiracy, which is new, is also worthless. The Form 1040, which is indistinguishable, is a worthless theory. The guy who brought it up, Richie, whoever Richie was a plaintiff, and he lost. He's a nice man. I took his seminar back in 1992, before Mr. Richie passed away. He lost, but that's another imagination theory. People start filing 1099 against an IRS agent. Not a very smart idea. They lost. The land patent idea. People claim you can get your land patent and your land is not subject to taxation and regulation and control. That's also worthless. That's not true. I've never seen anybody with any of these land patent experts, and the few that claim to be around, ever show me a court case that says it is. The ones they cite are they're reading out of context. The government has always had the power to do so. Let me give you an example. I was in San Diego, California. There was a historic site of the first courthouse and the post office of San Diego before the Civil War, the War of the States in 1850. It was an interesting thing. The curator told me something very interesting. She said back then, in the 1850s, California was nothing. Hardly anybody was around. One building was the post office and the courthouse and the people's home at the same time. So she said the way that they taxed people at the time was to, because the tax was used to pay the local sheriff, a local judge and district attorney, and that's all there was back then, was a tax based upon how many drawers you have in your home. Isn't that interesting? How many drawers do you have in your home? In other words, the richer you are, the more drawers you have, the more clothes you got, the more belongings you have. Was it these people that they were, was it those people, all frontier men, freedom lovers? They were not a bunch of sit-at-home, do-nothing, kick-back people. They took the track from east, U.S. to west. And they're not going to be out there allowing themselves to be oppressed when they have a small local government. That's local county taxes. So then these guys owned that land allodium. So here go the land patents. That's a page of mythology. Let's see here. I got my note here to say to go to page 63. I think we've already been there. Oh, the notice of, he's talking about notice of levy. And next, I'm not a person under the tax code. Well, the people claim they're not a person because they're sovereign. That's another argument, that they are a sovereign state citizen, so they're not a person. On the tax load, on the tax code, there's a lot of truth to that, but the courts have ruled against it, again, through public policy. Next, notice of levy is not a levy. That's a good and correct argument. My good friend Erwin Schiff brought it up, and he's right about it, but he's
in jail.
Notice of levy is when an IRS takes your paycheck, stealing it. They call that a levy. Notice of levy is not a levy, but the courts have said it is. Next is the UCC argument, and we've gone over that. Next is the CFR cross-referenced, the Code of Federal Regulations, and people take it out of context. The flag issue, again, it's a tooth fairy theory. Common law court or one Supreme Court a necessity, again, tooth fairy theory. Now, the flag issue, I'll tell you, in my trial, a couple of our defendants brought in a flag, set it on the table, and declared their citizenship under the flag. It was Judge Kuhnauer that was presiding, and he looked at the flag and just continued to go do what he was doing. And the argument or the statement of that the guys were making, you know, that they weren't under the jurisdiction, blah, 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 and that they were operating under the flag of the United States of America, not the flag of the United States, blah, blah, blah. And it just was like so much water off a duck's back. But they brought it in, they set it down, and they asserted it. Didn't make any difference. Again, they were arguing jurisdiction. And as we said before, if you're there in front of them, they've got jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And that's the way he ruled.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was interesting about Kuhnauer, this Citizens book was introduced as evidence. The Citizens Rule Book was introduced as evidence, and it was accepted. The next day, however, every page in here except the back page and the cover page was redacted.
Why? By who?
By the prosecutor.
Huh.
And it was reaccepted into evidence.
What's redacted mean?
Blacked out.
Blacked out.
Blacked out?
Yes.
Why would he have the right to do that if it had been originally accepted?
I don't know what the rule...
Because it was the king's court, and the king said, you can do whatever you want?
Essentially, right. And he also, I think it was at that time, stated that he would have no more arguments regarding the First or Second Amendments. Period. And my jaw went, huh? You know,
we were cooked. How about the 10th? Can we use the 10th?
So, it was interesting. But again, he was in charge. He had the power.
Yeah. Now, what about getting a jury to listen to your argument to try and override the judge? I mean, juries are pretty poisoned these days, but...
We attempted.
Had a chance for that.
We attempted.
That's been Red Beckman's big argument. Mm-hmm. Get a jury. Just get a jury, and then you got a chance.
Well, if you can get a proper jury and an informed jury,
yeah.
Or if you can inform the jury.
Which you're usually not allowed to.
Right.
Yeah.
Then you do have a chance because the jury is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But most everybody out here in na-na land has no idea what a jury is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So anyway, it goes to the UCC argument, the flag issue, and now, here we go. This is what I was wanting to get for. 65 to 67, yeah, that was Becraft's argument. Right. Okay, that's Beecraft's. Just the commentary, famous commentary on that. Next, you see an article by Larry Beecraft, and as it was presented in the Great Freedom Magazine Media Bypass in 1997. The poorly prepared patriots providing fodder for judicial canon. In this article, Beecraft basically explains patriot stupidity, and when you go home after listening to this, read what Larry wrote in this article so you understand how the judicial conspiracy works a little bit better. In other words, the judges rule against somebody, and then what happens is they cite the other judge's cites from the previous court. Your case could be different, but they ignore the differences because they want to rule against you. They have to maintain the status quo. It's been said they have been instructed not to allow any decision that could cause chaos. Their actions support that belief. For example, right now people are challenging the Social Security number issue. You don't have to have one. You don't have to give it to employers, stuff like that, or you don't have to give it to the DMV. And they're providing bad judicial cases for the judges to use against us. A friend of mine had a good case going on, a good case. You don't have to give your number to DMV, the Social Security number. Well, they kept delaying this case, and the judges kept allowing it to delay in the Court of Appeals until some other court in California ruled against another guy with the same issue who didn't know what the heck he was doing, and then they based their decision on what they told my friend. Hey, you lose too. Mm-hmm. So that's why you don't want to make arguments without knowing what you're doing. And on page 70...
Okay, what did they do wrong? They made an argument, there was no case against it, and then they just stalled until they got a case against it and put them out.
Right.
So they didn't have a bad argument necessarily.
Yeah.
So how can you fix that? How can you do anything about that?
You really can't, because their decision, decision was pending.
Right.
And since they hadn't done it, you couldn't appeal their decision or challenge it until they made their decision based on the other lower court. And by then, there was a precedent. And had you sent it to the Supreme Court, had they sent it to the Supreme Court, more than likely, 99.999%, the Supreme Court would have denied review.
Mm-hmm.
Certiorari, thereby letting it stand. So that's how the bad law gets to continue.
Okay, this is bad news.
Yeah, it is. Now, on page 71, this is a very interesting read. And I'm not going to take the time right now to read it, but I am going to go back through. This is from William Conklin, all right? A very learned paralegal, and he was asked to give his opinion relating to the liability clause in the Internal Revenue Code. On page, it's up here, and he goes through and does a very good job fleshing out the codes. Excuse me. And come on. Oh, page 76. Just about a third of the way down. An indent on the paragraph.
The key to change the name. It
says, keeping in mind the well-settled rule that the citizen is exempt from taxation unless the same is imposed by clear and unequivocal language, and that where the construction of a tax law is doubtful, the doubt is to be resolved in favor of those upon whom the tax is sought to be laid. This is a United States Supreme Court case, Spreckles Sugar Refining Company versus McLean. And it can be found in volume 192, page 397. and also in 24 Supreme Court at 382. It's a 1904 decision. It has never yet been overturned. And in Gould versus Gould, below it, in the interpretation of statutes, living taxes, it is the established rule not to extend their provisions by implication beyond the clear import of the language used, are to enlarge their operation so as to embrace matters not specifically pointed out. In case of doubt, they are construed most strongly against the government and in favor of the citizen. Again, Supreme Court decision, this was in 1917. That should just, little short thing right there, entice you to want to read the rest of his opinion. Hmm. We wanted to now discuss taxes in the United States Constitution.
Quite a long opinion here.
Yeah, and it's very well done.
Wow. Good paralegal.
We're going to discuss the constitutional authority of the income tax, or lack of it. And this is one of the things that's so important that I'm going to read it. So if you have questions, interrupt so we can all understand. The U.S. Constitution is the foundation of the taxing authority in this country for the federal government. The states, remember, can tax under their state constitution much more broadly and loosely than the federal government. From it comes the instructions for imposing taxes that the Congress and Supreme Court are bound to honor. They are bound to honor it as long as they don't agree to ignore it. That's how it should be, but they're not honorable, unfortunately. The Constitution determined all taxes fall into either one of two categories, direct or indirect. There is no other class of taxation recognized with Congress or with the Supreme Court or allowed under the Constitution. A direct tax is a tax levied directly by the government on the individual taxpayer. Direct taxes are provided for in Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution. Representatives and direct taxes should be apportioned among states included in this union according to the respective number. This section goes on to determine how the population of each state shall be counted by census. Apportion means to assign state representatives within a state according to the number of people counted. In case of direct taxes, the amount assigned to each individual taxed directly can legally be no more or less than that assigned to any other individual. Apportionment meant that the total amount owed by a state is determined by population, and that amount would then be divided evenly among the population. That's a pretty comprehensive method. That was the original intent of the Constitution, in proportion to the population. An example, if Congress determined it needed to raise $50,000, Washington and every other state would receive a bill for $1,000. 50 states times 1,000 equals 50,000. If California had 100 population, each individual would receive a tax bill for $10 from the state. If Washington had 200 population, each individual would receive a tax bill for $20 from the state. After the state received the money from each individual, it could pay its federal tax bill. The state of California would collect from its citizens, Arizona from its citizens, New York from its citizens, and so forth, and then send it to the federal government. The state would directly tax the people. This was ignored right away after they passed the Constitution. You know, they started saying the federal government can directly tax you. That's the way they did it with income tax. Student comment. The writers of the Constitution were so adamant about this that they went on to write in Article 1, Section 1, quote, "No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before taken." Capitation means head tax. You've heard of decapitation, where they cut off someone's head? That means no head tax. No head tax or tax per human head. Direct taxes have to be in proportion to the census. Student, For a direct tax to be lawfully laid, it must be apportioned to the state. The U.S. Supreme Court in Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust, 158 U.S. 601, that a direct tax not based on apportionment is unlawful and cannot be permitted to be mandatory. My aside. This case, Pollock case versus Farmers Loan and Trust, is an excellent, and there's a couple others that follow it. But if you understand how to bring this issue in, Pollock has never been overturned. Mm-hmm. And neither have the ones that follow it. Mm. But you have to understand how to get it into court according to the court rules before it could be looked at. And most of the arguments that have been brought forth on this have not been allowed or have not done it properly. And so bad law has occurred.
Follows bad practice.
Right. The name of the site is enough for this tape, which was 158 U.S. 601. The Congress said, or the court said, it was a very difficult thing to tax directly, but indirect taxes were deliberately allowed to be much more easily laid because this is the way they want the government to make its money. Not directly off the people, but indirectly. Student, indirect taxes are taxes on events or activities and not on persons or properties. These taxes are hidden within the price of an item which is purchased. Indirect taxes are provided for in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. It is one of the 18 powers granted to the Congress. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. All right. I like to use the example. When you purchase gasoline, you pay an excise tax. That is an indirect tax. When, now, you don't have to purchase gasoline, so you don't have to pay the tax. But if you purchase the gasoline, you have to pay the tax. Once you purchase the gasoline, you become liable for the tax, and you pay it. If you don't purchase the gasoline, you're not liable for the tax and you don't pay it. But it's an indirect tax. It's not a direct tax, you know, to you as the purchaser. So trying to get this concept between direct and indirect and how does it fall through, because sometimes when you're reading the court cases on that, the language that they use and the way they put them in there, it gets a little confusing at times. So as long as you've got it in your head, what is a direct tax and what is an indirect tax? The indirect tax are the impost, excises, and duties. A direct tax is one that they come to you, it's a capitation tax. Hey, you owe $5. Mm-hmm. Okay? So trying to keep that straight, it's important.
Is there ever an indirect tax that affects everybody?
Well, I mean, gasoline pretty much affects everybody.
It's uniform. All right? The federal tax on gasoline is uniform throughout the states. Mm-hmm. Doesn't make any difference what state you go to, what county, what city. Mm-hmm. When you buy a gallon of gasoline, you pay a certain percentage of that as federal tax. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, in that case, it affects everybody that purchases. When you purchase a pair of shoes, there's an excise tax on that. That's a federal excise tax, which is a certain percentage of the sale of the shoe. And everybody that buys that shoe pays that in that excise tax.
But for the most part, indirect taxes are
self-selected. I mean, you have to walk it on your bare feet.
Right. Yeah, you don't have to buy them, but it's probably a good idea if you do. Okay. Taxes had already been defined in Article 1, Section 2 as being apportioned. Duties and excises are all direct taxes and specified to be uniform. I think he means indirect.
Yeah.
Thus we have a direct tax apportioned and indirect taxes unapportioned. Mm-hmm. These two rules, the rule of apportionment in regard to direct taxes and uniformity to indirect taxes, have never been repealed since they are embodied in the very foundation of the Constitution and thus are still the law of the land.
And apportionment always means by person, by head, right? Or can it be apportioned by other things like by state or apportioned by county?
No, to the population. So, okay. Yeah.
So it's to the, based on the census.
Right. So let me clarify the uniformity, in other words, to better see what the Constitution means. Before the Constitution, New York could charge one thing on its harbor, for an example, someone importing an item, and then Massachusetts could charge another rate. If you're going to tax the imports of sugar, for example, whether the sugar comes from California, New York, or Florida, the rate is the same. It's uniform. So if somebody's bringing 10 tons of sugar into New York Harbor, New York couldn't say, okay, we're going to charge you 50%. And Massachusetts couldn't say, well, we want more, we're going to charge 75%. And Rhode Island says, oh, forget those guys over here, we're going to charge you 25%. They can't do that under the Constitution. As a state, by one of their rights of being able to tax, they can, but they are bound by the Constitution. So whatever the feds set, if the feds set 75%, then Rhode Island, New York, and Massachusetts would all have charged 75%. Mm-hmm. But they don't set them that high. Student. Question. If the Constitution already provided in Article 1, Section 8 for direct taxes upon the people, why is the 16th Amendment needed at all? And we will get to that. Be patient.
It's not a portion.
The class has been in such a way that the next thought's probably coming up, so be patient. Student, the Supreme Court has uniformly held this as law. In Tyler versus U.S., at page 502, the court ruled, quote, the tax laid upon the happening of event, as distinguished from its tangible fruits, is an indirect tax. Boy, what did that say? The tax laid upon the happening of an event is distinguished from its tangible fruits is an indirect tax. In the happening of an event, for example, sales tax. Sugar is bought, you have to pay the sales tax on that, and that was meant to be that way because the government could only tax items so much. If you recall the Stamp Tax Act, King George laid on the colonies that resulted in the Boston Tea Party. A tax was laid on the number of pages in a book and on the number of words it contained. If they raised it too much, the people would not buy the item anymore. That was exactly the purpose of having the federal government raise its money on indirect taxes. Now, I had read the Stamp Tax Act, and I recall in there that they taxed the number of periods that were in print. Yeah. Can you imagine? I mean, you understand why they went Boston Tea Party in that revolt? It was a natural controller of how much the government can tax, because if they raise it too much, people will not buy the item. They'll go throw it in the ocean anymore, or they will try to figure out a way to smuggle it or get out of it. If you keep the tax low, then people will just pay if it's a small item, small percentage. That's the intent. Indirect tax is only upon an event. It is not made upon the actual fruits of the event, and therefore the income produced, and thus the income is not the subject of the tax. It is the yardstick used to measure what is owed on the event, which is taxable. This is a complex distinction, and one needs to be patient to unravel and understand it. It's the yardstick. The corporation goes out here and sells 10,000 widgets at a dollar a piece. The tax is on the income. Is the $10,000 the income? I'm getting into this a little deep.
Gross or net? Is that what you're asking?
No. Is it income? We haven't covered this.
Depends on the value of the product.
We haven't covered this, so that's a trick question, all right? Number one, the question should be, what's income?
Yeah.
The Supreme Court has defined income as the profit or gain.
Right, profit. So
on a corporation.
So the value of the item versus the price is how you determine the income.
Okay, so they sold 10,000 widgets at $1 a piece for $10,000. How much did it cost them? Let's assume for a minute it cost them $5,000 to produce them. Mm-hmm. So their profit, their income, would be $5,000.
That's what would be taxed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the widgets they were taxing. Mm-hmm. It was the income that was the event was.
So it was an excise on income, right, as defined as profit. So really it was an excise on profit.
Right.
Which seems fair enough. I don't know.
But that was the intent of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Okay. But again, when we come to these kind of crazy descriptions and so forth, we need to take the time to discuss them so that we can understand the process. Mm-hmm. Okay. He says, let me explain that to you. The income itself was not the subject of the tax. It's a yardstick used to measure the tax. What is meant by it? You have the right to the fruits of your labor. That cannot be taxed the way the Constitution was originally meant. Not unless very, very, excuse me, strict rules with regard to direct taxation are laid out in the Constitution. However, let's suppose it's a corporation. Corporations can be taxed. Why? Because a corporation is not a real human being. A corporation is an artificial entity. Artificial entities can be taxed because a corporation is totally fiction.
And it's created by the state. It's owned by the state. So.
It's not real. It's right. Not a human being. Mm-hmm. How did corporations get to be? It's an interesting history. Way back in Europe in the 14 and 1500s, it goes that far back. A super rich person wanted to do something with a great venture, but he didn't want people to get hurt as a result of his business venture. So this rich person went to the King of England and said, hey, King, let's do this. I'm willing to make you my partner and pay you a good amount of money if you allow me to do business instead of as myself as a fictional corporation. In fact, corporation comes from the Latin word corpus, which means body. This fictional body doesn't exist. We call it a corpus, a body. I'll own the shares of this, and me and my buddies will pay you taxes on it. You can control and regulate us to make sure we don't do things wrong. But the bottom line is, if my venture doesn't work, a lot of people could get hurt financially, and they cannot, and I want to protect myself so that they cannot come and take me or my huge empire or of wealth. They cannot sue me for that. They can only sue whatever assets, money, and things I put into this corporation. This body corp is supposedly its own thing and its own being. The king thinks about it, and he likes it. He says, yeah, I'll make more money. I can always use that for my military ventures and concubines and whatever waste and fraud I want to do. Building more jails and bribes and pay people well to be loyal to me and all that stuff. So he goes for it. And they get more and more of it going. But the king says, now because I am the government, the sovereign, and the king, I allowed this fictional body to be formed and recognized. So you're right. It is formed by the state. Mm-hmm.
It's why? Limited, all corporations are limited liability corporations. That's their purpose.
Why? Because they, the kings, the governments, have the power. That's why it exists. Mm-hmm. Okay? Who can do that? Me. Because I said so. I'm the king. I'm acting like God. Creating make-believe that doesn't exist. And you cannot create real things. The government can create make-believe things, the corporation. So they can tax you and regulate you through the corporation. That's the traditional history of corporations. Subject to the charter of the corporation, which is the paper by the government allowing it to exist, it can be taken back by the government which created it. The corporation would then be closed. The government and the king can do that. So there are different corporations in business. One is the insurance company. Another one sells shoes. Another provides computer software services. Another one makes cameras. Another one raises rice on a farm. These are corporations. How do you tax these corporations? You know, in an unapportioned way. They all have a different product or service. By the amount of life insurance they sell? By the amount of number of shoes? By what? Well, the thing they all have in common with its farming manufacturing service, whatever it is that they all receive money, and they all make a profit. So the best measure of tax of how much activity they are doing is by that, because the more activity the corporation does, the more chances are likely that it might do something that could hurt people. Small corporations can only do so much activity, so it can only hurt a little people. So few people will complain to me, the king. But the big corporations can do all this stuff, like Exxon Valdez in Alaska a few years ago, and BP now in the Gulf, and destroyed a great part of Alaska and fishing and coastlines, and all with the oil spill. That can do big damage because it did more activity, so the profits of the corporation, the income, what is taxed. The more money you make, the more tax. It's a nice, unapportioned way of taxing. So income was originally meant, and still is, by the Supreme Court decision, the corporate profit, the measure of the privilege of activity you're doing business as a corporation. Not as yourself, not Rockefeller, not as a super rich banker or businessman, but as a fictional make-believe entity to protect all the billions and hundreds of billions of assets from a lawsuit in case you do wrong. That's what it is. So let's go on. Just a few more here and we'll be done. Approaching time. Well, before the 16th Amendment in Flint versus Stone Tracy, the Supreme Court determined that indirect taxes are never upon property, money, or any other tangible assets, but only levied on taxable activities. The income from these activities is a measure of the taxability of the activities, but the activity is itself not taxable. The 16th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, supposedly the IRS, claims that, that is what the IRS claims allows the income tax to be, was allegedly ratified in 1913. This case was in 1911, 2 years before that. Speaking of Flint versus Tracy. Any tax directly on income would have to, by constitutional law, be apportioned. Congress then attempted to make an amendment to the Constitution which would eliminate the burden of apportionment with regard to direct taxes. This amendment could not, however, fulfill that purpose because it came in direct conflict with the constitutional purpose that all direct taxes must be apportioned. And again, if we look at the book The Law That Never Was by Bill Benson. Benson got documents to prove that the 16th Amendment of the Constitution was not ever properly ratified, and Flander Knox, Secretary of State at the time, knew that this was a fraud. But he declared it to be ratified anyway. That's not the point. Even assuming if the 16th Amendment was ratified properly, there are more problems with it. At the end of the main body of the Constitution is a fail-safe clause inserted by the writers to ensure that their document would be secure from meddling attempts to dismantle their work, including attempts to nullify the original work by amendments which might contradict it. The Constitution and the laws of the United States shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, and anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Article 6, Clause 2. Thus, with one bold stroke, the writers, with their construction, said that anything which should come later and contradict what had already been put in the Constitution would be automatically null and void. The plan was, don't mess with this Constitution. You cannot just add or change it and have it be going against the existing Constitution. All judges everywhere in America must follow it. That was the plan. That was the idea. And we are going to let it happen. And we are going to get to the 16th Amendment to see what happens. Student, do those judges have to take an oath, and at what level? Do they take it at the tax court level and at the Supreme Court level? At every level, they have to take the oath. So let's see what the 16th Amendment reads. The 16th Amendment to the Constitution reads, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states, without regard to any census or enumeration." Besides sounding like a constitutional debate on the direct contradiction of the apportionment restriction on direct taxes, this amendment is easily the least understood and the most misapplied, because this income tax did not require apportionment. The Supreme Court ruled that it had to fall in the category of indirect tax. Otherwise, it would be in direct conflict with what was in the main body of the Constitution and thus be null and void. Hold on. See, this 16th Amendment appears to get rid of those restrictions of direct taxation of the Constitution. That's what it looks like. It says, look, Congress can tax incomes for whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states, without regard to any census. The problem is this. You cannot have Part A of the Constitution that's already there and the new Part B being a contradiction. You cannot have it at the same time say the direct tax is one thing and something else. So what the Supreme Court should have done is said, hey people, American people, sorry, you know what? You all made a big legal error. Boo-boo. Congress, you proposed the law incorrectly. You should have repealed that direct taxing clause, or you should have taken that clause out and modified the whole thing. You could not say this and at the same time leave the direct taxing clause in there. If you repeal the other sections and say direct taxes must be apportioned, except on income, that would be okay. Following, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that. They did it in a way that the old stuff was there and the new stuff was a contradiction. Not one thing was done to embarrass the Congress and the American people and the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court instead chose to place the income tax in the category of direct taxes, which it does not belong. By its nature, obviously. We tax you and the next guy, but we tax each of you indirectly. That is the nature of direct tax. But to avoid this embarrassment, they said, oh well, we will make it an indirect tax. How is that? Most people do not understand. I did not. These are fine points of law to make. That was the problem with this whole thing, the problem with the income tax. 3 years after the amendment was ratified, there is no incontrovertible evidence that it was not legally ratified, but that is irrelevant to the discussion. The court made it clear that an income tax could not be classified as a direct tax. The 16th Amendment conferred no new power of taxation. It simply prohibited the complete power of taxation possessed by Congress from the beginning by being taken out of the category of direct taxation, which it inherently belonged. Here they are saying the 16th Amendment did not give Congress a new taxing power. In the Stanton case, remember this one, Stanton is one of those famous cases that said the 16th Amendment did not give Congress new taxing power. So why does the IRS claim their authority comes from the 16th Amendment? Don't they read these Supreme Court cases? Apparently not. Or they choose to ignore them along with the federal courts of appeals and the modern-day Supreme Court judges, who also choose to ignore it, in order not to upset the apple cart. The reason for this is the apportionment provision, which had been tested in the Pollock case,
hey Bex, I'm in class.
pages to go.
Okay.
Okay. Got about 2 more pages to go.
Okay.
All right. In the Pollock case, some years before had not been, indeed could not be, overridden by the 16th Amendment. In 1916, the court ruled the proposition in contention under it, the 16th Amendment, The lawyers were arguing about the proportion and that the 16th Amendment and the contentions under that theory in the 16th Amendment would cause one provision of the Constitution to destroy the other. That is, they would result in bringing the provisions of the amendment exempting a direct tax from apportionment into irreconcilable conflict with a general requirement that all direct taxes be apportioned. This does not result in simplifying the situation and making clear the limitations on the taxing, which obviously the amendment intended to accomplish, which would create radical and destructive changes in our constitutional system and multiplied confusion. The court was saying here that the problem was it was expected to be a direct tax, it would create confusion. Well, gee. How could there be a prohibition against all direct taxation, yet here it's allowed? It cannot be. So they place it in the category of indirect taxation because they want to give the government the presumption of correctness. Everything the government does is correct or presumed to be. They want to say, hey, all you did was make a mistake, okay? All right. Neither Breschebert nor Pollock has ever been overridden, nor have they been challenged. Instead, they were confirmed by the ruling of Evan versus Gore. The 16th Amendment does not justify taxation of person or things. They're properly previously immune. It doesn't extend taxing power to a new or accepted citizens. It was intended only to remove all occasions of any apportionment of income taxes among the states. It does not authorize a tax on salary. In Eisner versus McComber, the Supreme Court attempted to clarify the language used in the 16th Amendment. And that pretty well wraps it up for today.
So the conclusion of the 16th Amendment effectively did nothing.
Yep.
Except to add confusion and clarity.
Well, yeah, to add confusion and clarity, right. About the only thing it did was remove the income tax into a... I get this confused.
Indirect
myself.
Tax on incomes among the states.
Yeah.
Corporate incomes.
It removed it from the category that was originally done and placed it in the indirect category. And that prevented the income tax from being apportioned as a direct tax. So they don't have to apportion it anymore.
So they can tax corporations,
yeah,
based on income and not have to apportion it.
Right.
Right.
So
it has nothing to do with personal wages.
It's not.
Never did.
And at our next session, I'm going to try and bring up a copy of the original 1861 and 1862 law stating who is taxable and why.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that in my notes someplace, and I'm going to do my best to research it and get it back out and give you guys a copy of it. See, it's real interesting.
Cool.
It's the law as was enacted by Congress and has never been overturned and is currently in the code. Alrighty.
Okay.
So your homework for today basically would be just to go back in and see, read Conklin's.
Yeah, that looks like a really good article.
Opinion.
Okay.
All right. And then if there's any questions on it, well, we can discuss that in that session. Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. Now, as I say, I'm not going to continue to parrot payment, but for the moment, at this stage within the course, I think it's best that I do, just so that we are sure we stay on track and get the proper information put forth.
Good.
So Okay. Yeah. Very good.